What happens when an American investment banker spends 25 years watching a nation of 1 billion people reinvent capitalism? In 1997, Henry Paulson walked through Beijing just days after Deng Xiaoping's death, stepping into a relationship with China that would span financial crises, environmental disasters, and the most remarkable economic transformation in human history. Over the next quarter century, he would witness China evolve from an impoverished nation where bicycles clogged the streets to an economic superpower with gleaming skyscrapers and bullet trains. His journey offers a rare insider's view of how China actually works, not the China of Western imagination, but the messy, pragmatic, sometimes brilliant reality of a country racing to modernize while holding on to political control. The China that Paulson first encountered in the early 1990s barely resembled the modern powerhouse we know today. Beijing's ancient Hatong neighborhoods were vanishing overnight, replaced by massive construction projects. In Shenzhen, forests of cranes stretched to the horizon. This frenetic energy had roots in Deng Xiaoping's 1978 decision to abandon Mao's ideological obsessions for something radically pragmatic. Make people rich first, worry about theory later. Deng's declaration that it doesn't matter whether a cat is black or white as long as it catches mice became the philosophical foundation for China's economic transformation. The household responsibility system replaced collective farming, boosting grain yields 34% between 1978 and 1984. When Deng proclaimed, "To get rich is no sin," entrepreneurs like Liu Chuanqi, Lenovo, and Zhang Qingho seized the moment. The economy roared at 10% annual growth until the 1989 Tiananmen crackdown threatened everything. Then, Deng, at 88, took his famous 1992 Southern Tour, declaring reform irreversible. GDP surged 14% that year. Paulson's logic was simple. The four Asian tigers combined had only one-third of China's population. By 1997, China needed to transform bloated state-owned enterprises employing 110 million workers into competitive companies. Vice Premier Zhu Rongji's bold plan, use public markets to force reform. China Telecom's IPO would be the test case. There was just one problem. China Telecom didn't exist as a company. It was a bureaucratic maze with no ownership structure, no financial statements, and no corporate governance. Goldman Sachs had to create a company before they could take it public. The 1997 Asian financial crisis hit when Thailand's baht plummeted 20% on July 2nd. By October 23rd, Black Thursday, Hong Kong's Hang Seng crashed 10%, just as China Telecom prepared to go public. Despite opening sharply lower, the deal closed, raising $4.22 billion. Wang Qishan reported to Zhu Rongji, calling it Jin Jin Bai Yin, real gold and silver. Shares traded 13% above offer by year's end, establishing the template for reforming state-owned giants. Meanwhile, Guangdong province exposed the boom's dark side. When Goldman Sachs restructured Guangdong enterprises in 1997, they found $6 billion in debt, but no clarity on assets. Investigators discovered an eel farm whose eels had washed away, a Paris hotel, submerged Thai beachfront property, and rampant fraud. This was capitalism without rules. China's leaders made a radical call: no bailout. Zhu Rongji liquidated another failing company, killing the chicken to scare the monkey. Consequence-free failure was over. Oil symbolized Chinese national pride and self-sufficiency. After 1949, Mao turned to the Soviets to break foreign oil dependence. When Docking Field was discovered in 1959, Iron Man Wang Jinsi became a national hero, drilling in minus 30 C temperatures. By the 1970s, docking produced three-quarters of China's oil, making China a net exporter. But explosive growth changed everything. By 1994, China was importing again. The state-owned China National Petroleum Corporation desperately needed modernization, yet it wasn't really a company. It was a city-state providing housing, schools, hospitals, even mortuaries for over a million workers. The 2000 PetroChina IPO required over 1,000 professionals working months to disentangle business from social services. Despite terrible timing, the dot-com bubble, low oil prices, human rights protests, the transformation worked. 15 years later, PetroChina became the world's biggest listed oil producer, briefly topping $1 trillion in market value. But laid-off workers, whose severance ran out, returned demanding more, triggering riots across China's oil regions. China was modernizing at breakneck speed, leaving millions behind without the social safety net Western countries built over decades. In Mao's China, commercial banks barely existed. When reform began in 1978, China created four major banks that operated like government agencies, funding growth projects regardless of creditworthiness. By 1997, at least 25% of loans were non-performing. The real figure approached 50%. The Asian financial crisis exposed these weaknesses, prompting Zhu Rongji to move bad loans into asset management companies, holding $170 billion by 2000. In fall 2004, ICBC asked if Goldman Sachs would become a strategic investor before its IPO. Paulson hesitated due to bad loans. Then Goldman discovered something astonishing. ICBC had $600 billion in deposits, with $225 million flooding in daily. Government-set interest spreads guaranteed hefty profits. Despite its problems, ICBC was the world's biggest mattress, a profit machine with 150 million customers and 17% of China's banking assets. In July 2006, Goldman, Alliance, and American Express purchased 8.45% for $3.8 billion. ICBC's October 2006 IPO raised a record $21.9 billion. As Treasury Secretary in 2006, Paulson's first China visit felt radically different from his previous 70 trips as a banker. President Hu once confided his nightmare, creating 25 million jobs annually. With Communist Party legitimacy tied to prosperity, Paulson developed the Strategic Economic Dialogue to address China's complex decision-making. The inaugural December 2006 SED brought 28 U.S. delegates to Beijing, producing agreements on export financing, allowing NYSE and NASDAQ China offices, and restarting airline negotiations. By June 2008, as the U.S. financial crisis deepened, Wang Qishan spoke with unusual candor at the Strategic Economic Dialogue. "You were my teacher, but now here I am in my teacher's domain. And look at your system, Hank. We aren't sure we should be learning from you anymore." As Bear Stearns collapsed and Lehman Brothers teetered, Chinese leaders questioned Paulson intensely about their money-losing investments. The irony was bitter. Americans had lectured China about market discipline for years, yet now the American financial system was imploding while China's heavily regulated banks remained stable. The crisis spread with terrifying speed. Money market funds failed, commercial paper markets froze, and Chinese banks began withdrawing. On November 9th, Beijing announced a massive $586 billion stimulus program focused on infrastructure, enabling state-owned banks to launch a trillion-dollar lending campaign. China's economy roared back while America struggled through years of anemic growth. The student had become the teacher's lifeline, a psychological shift that proved profound and lasting. When questioned about helping China, Paulson's answer was clear. China's reform serves American interests. Every major global challenge, economic stability, environmental protection, security, becomes easier when the world's two largest economies cooperate rather than collide. Despite its 10 trillion economy, China faces enormous challenges. Per capita GDP ranks 80th globally, roughly 1/8 of America's. The country must shift from exports and inefficient government investment toward domestic consumption and high-end services. Debt surged from 130% of GDP in 2008 to over 206% by 2014, dangerously high and growing faster than GDP. Yet China's private sector has exploded from near extinction under Mao to roughly 60% of GDP. Self-made entrepreneurs like Jack Ma, Alibaba's record $25 billion IPO, and Ponyma, Tencent's 470 million users, are building global companies rivaling any in the world. The best path forward turns shared interests into shared successes. Joint humanitarian missions, environmental initiatives, educational exchanges, and cross-investment create interdependence that discourages conflict. The U.S.-China relationship will define the 21st century. We can compete without seeking each other's destruction. Our challenge is ensuring this transformation unfolds peacefully, requiring the wisdom, patience, and sustained engagement Paulson spent 25 years building.